Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at the Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is Cure Panel's 72nd episode, and today on our myeloma broadcast, we are discussing bone damage in myeloma. My co-host for the show is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are Cure panelists Pat Killingsworth, Jack Ayulo, and Cynthia Schmilewski. I welcome the panel to the show. We are discussing bone damage in myeloma with a very eminent expert, Dr. Amrita Krishnan, the director of City of Hope's Multiple Myeloma Program. Welcome to the show, Dr. Krishnan. It's great to have you with us. Although multiple myeloma is classified as a blood cancer, patients with this disease often experience bone-related symptoms like bone pain, frequent fractures, and spots of low bone density or bone damage that show up during a skeletal scan. In the coming hour, we are going to discuss and learn how multiple myeloma affects bone health and how this impacts the patient. Gary Peterson will introduce our story expert and begin with the discussion. Before I hand over to Gary, I would like to tell all our listeners that we will be addressing questions towards the end of the show. And if you want to ask a question to our panel, you can press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you on air to ask your question. Alternatively, you can email your question to me. My mailing ID is priya@trilix.com. With that, it's over to Gary. Gary, you're on air.
Well, thank you, Priya. I really do appreciate, again, all the things you do to assist and to aid all of us who are fighting multiple myeloma and all of its effects, including bone disease. And thank you so much, Dr. Krishnan, for providing us with your time. Dr. Krishnan is the director of the Multiple Myeloma Program at the City of Hope Hospital in California. She's a professor, associate director, medical education and training in hematology and hematopoietic cell transplantation. She's also been, in her background, a graduate in medicine from Albany Medical College in Albany, New York, and Union College in Schenectady, New York, in biology and modern languages, and she knows French. She not only is an excellent doctor, but I find out that she is also a fellow many times over. She's a clinical fellow at clinical medicine at Harvard School of Business, or Harvard Medical School, I'm sorry.
Well, that was in my past life. That was many years ago now, Gary.
Okay. And also research fellow, Division of Hematologic Malignancy at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, if we have to drop a name or two. In addition, also Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, a fellow there as well. And also the Bone Marrow Transplantation and Solid Tumor and Lymphoma Autologous Marrow Program at Dana-Farber Institute and Beth Israel Hospital. So you are a jolly good fellow, I would say.
Well, I'm happy to be out of the cold and the snow, though, I have to say.
Okay. Well, welcome to the program, and thank you so much. So if you might, Priya had said previously, multiple myeloma is a cancer of the plasma cells in the bone marrow. So why would there be any bone involvement at all? Is this metastasis, as we might see this in other types of malignancies, or is it something other than that?
So that's a great question, Gary. And I mean, just to sort of take a step back and say, clearly for patients with myeloma, bone or skeletal events, as we call it, are really obviously one of the most distressing complications of the disease. So, clearly there's been a lot of research in trying to understand why does it happen. And we realize now that it is different from other cancers where it's not sort of a direct extension of disease, but it's really from these malignant plasma cells themselves, as well as the bone marrow sort of environment in which those cells reside. And what they do is they send signals, sort of cytokines, as it be, certain ones that stimulate basically the osteoclasts, the cells in the bones that eat the bones, and then they inhibit the osteoblasts, the cells that sort of grow bone. So the term we use is basically the uncouple bone remodeling. So all of us, our bones are constantly sort of turning over, because otherwise, you know, we'd all be 10 foot tall and our chins would be, you know, out to the across the room. So our bone turnover actually is every 7 years we've completely sort of remodeled our skeleton. And myeloma, that gets completely out of whack, and we basically spend more time breaking down our bones and not building them up.
So that's really, it's just part of the disease as opposed to like a
right,
metastasis, going from one place to another.
But the reason it's also important, if I could just say, is because then it helps us in terms of trying to find medicines to prevent that from happening.
Okay. We see some patients who are confronted with extensive bone involvement, and one of those people are on this call. That's Pat Killingsworth. So I'm sure that Pat is going to have a number of very personal questions, perhaps. And then other people like myself, you know, I was lucky. I had five lytic lesions, and they were, you know, in my breastbone, but never had any bone pain. So why, you know, why are some people? And I've seen other people who have lost like 6 or 8 inches because their spines collapse. So, you know, why do some people have this involvement and others don't?
So, you know, that's another great question, Gary. I think, you know, it really speaks, you've actually just sort of very eloquently put it, that everyone's myeloma is different. So it really has to do with the biology of your own plasma cells. And, you know, we sort of anecdotally say, you know, if you think about it, you know, the patients and with myeloma that you know, you tend to have people who have a lot of kidney damage versus people who have bones. And, you know, so it tends to be one or the other, for example. And so those plasma cells, again, it really depends on what signals they're sending, what proteins they're producing, and what signals they're sending to the, you know, cytokines and IL-6, tumor necrosis factor, osteoblast inhibitory factors, the things that they're secreting from those plasma cells. And, you know, as we get smarter, we probably will be able to even narrow that down further in terms of figuring out in each individual patient sort of their own profile of what their plasma cells are going to be more predisposed to do.
Okay, is there a correlation then between the type of myeloma, high risk, low risk, kappa, lambda, and the likelihood of bone involvement, or the type of bone involvement that you can, you know, that you can conclude based on your research to date?
Mm-hmm. So not to date, you know, we do see correlation not with bone disease, though. You know, as you know, patients who have light chain myeloma clearly have a correlation with kidney failure, you know, just from the mechanics of light chain deposition in the kidneys. But we've not seen a clear sort of grouping of patients based on subtype yet, or cytogenetic risk group, or anything associated with bone disease.
Okay. You know, and I guess the other thing too is that if you have it, what are the standard treatments or, you know, standards of care for people who have bone involvement, or is it the same standard for people with and without?
You know, I'm sure from your experience with myeloma that you and all the callers on the line know that there's nothing in myeloma is really straightforward. So there's many opinions, and some of it certainly is data driven, but the data can only take us so far. And what I mean by that is, you know, clearly some of the original trials showed that the use of bisphosphonates reduced skeletal events. You're probably familiar with that recent British trial, the MRC9 trial, that compared an oral bisphosphonate to zoledric acid, and again showed, in fact, a survival benefit for the zoledric acid in that trial that was given for 12 months. So just to kind of speak to the controversies, and, you know, I think we certainly all agree about the use of bisphosphonates in patients with active myeloma. We don't have agreement on the length of therapy of bisphosphonates because obviously the concerns about long-term use and side effects. And we don't have an agreement in terms of in patients in much earlier myeloma, you know, so-called smoldering myeloma, where I would say some people use it, but it's really not been the standard of care to do it in that setting.
Okay. Another thing, some myeloma specialists believe, you know, that hidden in these bone lesions are, you know, some of the most cantankerous myeloma cells that, you know, they just sit in there, and unless you resolve those bone lesions, you can't ensure long-term survival. So what are your thoughts on that, you know, that you have to resolve bone lesions in order to ensure long-term survival?
Well, I think it's sort of two questions. One is really what type of bone lesions, right? So, you know, if you look at a PET scan and you see hot spots, you know, certainly I know in certain centers they would go and biopsy those spots to see if there are truly plasma cells there. So sometimes it's still hard to differentiate what's an active bone lesion versus what's an old, basically, you know, dead bone lesion that's taking, you know, bone remodeling still, even in successfully treated myeloma, it will take a long time for bones to heal. And, you know, they generally never go back to, quote unquote, a truly normal bone, though they will heal and you'll see evidence of sclerosis. And if you look at sort of just people, for example, treated with bortezomib, we know that if you look at indices of bone remodeling, they do improve, so that we can get sort of bone growth.
Okay, so you know, one of the things that comes out of this is that there's still a lot that's unresolved as far as exactly what to do.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I would say that. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'd say the easiest things are certainly clearly that we do use bisphosphonates. They've clearly reduced skeletal events. There's, you know, potential that they may improve survival, again with some caveats about that trial. And then other things that, you know, I certainly recommend for my patients in terms of vitamin D supplementation. Those are sort of the easy things that I think are much less controversial in regards to helping patients with their bone health.
Okay. Well, fantastic, Doctor. Now we'll open it up to the panel. I know that, like I said, a number of people, not only the panel, but we've got a lot of questions also from people who have sent questions in beforehand. Jack, are you there?
I am, Gary.
All right, Jack. You're on.
Dr. Krishnan, it's a pleasure to listen to your answers. And, Gary, those were really good questions to ask as well. I wanted to ask one of the questions as kind of a follow-up, Dr. Krishnan, where you said there really isn't complete agreement on how long bisphosphonates should be used, or should they be used in early smoldering patients, for example. But what about the patient that has been diagnosed as myeloma? Some show active lesions, some don't. Should bisphosphonates be used for all myeloma patients?
It's another great question. I mean, I would imagine that most centers have their own individual guidelines. So we have our own set of guidelines. And so we have put it in as sort of an equivocal consider its use for those groups of patients. And so not for smoldering, but for patients with active myeloma, no bony lesions, we've put it in as sort of consider using it.
How do you make that decision?
Well, that kind of leaves it open for each individual physician based on sort of what their read of the data is. So what we do know, you know, for example, is that the bisphosphonates, and certainly especially zoledric acid, has anti-myeloma effects itself in the lab if you treat myeloma cells with it. So, you know, I certainly actually do use it because I think you probably, you know, you get some increased benefit versus, you know, the potential risk of side effects, which is low, especially if you're going to use it short term.
If a patient had high risk factors, such as from FISH or cytogenetics, would that also cause you to say, yeah, it's a good idea if we start it?
No, you know, I haven't really used that to drive my decision in terms of doing it. It's really just been more, I would say, probably people more advanced stage disease, for example. So I've generally been in favor of using it, but I've certainly seen other patients where it's not been used for those very earlier stage patients with no bone lesions.
And then my second question is that for years we've heard of denosumab as a potential replacement for Iridia or Zometa. Can you provide kind of the latest information? We've had some people in our support group actually have denosumab recommended as their bone treatment.
Right. So, you know, denosumab's a tricky one because it's certainly still a work in progress. So, you know, first of all, it's obviously a very different class of drugs. It's an anti-Lank ligand antibody. So, you know, it basically inhibits the Rank ligand, basically stops osteoblasts, the stuff that grows bones. So if you inhibit that, you basically can grow more bone. So there was a trial in 2006 looking at myeloma patients and breast cancer patients comparing denosumab to pimidronate. And they showed sort of bone markers were dramatically dropped in the denosumab group. And they looked at them for basically a couple months, about 80 days. And they compared those to the pimidronate group, and the denosumab group clearly had a more sustained reduction in these bone markers. So it looked like it was a very favorable avenue in terms of reducing bone turnover. But, you know, the problem is still we're waiting for what we call kind of hard endpoints, meaning skeletal events. And the good news is those skeletal events are rarer these days, you know, so it takes, but the bad news is then it takes longer to see that and see a true benefit. The other part, which for reasons we don't really understand in that initial trial, in fact, that where there was a higher death rate in the denosumab arm, especially in the myeloma patients. So there's a separate international study that's going on right now, really looking at that more conclusively in myeloma patients. So in the absence of that, you know, we work very closely with our endocrinologists. And are there patients that we've given denosumab to with myeloma? Sure. And those patients have been the ones, for example, we have several patients who have been on long-term bisphosphonates and really looking by bone markers or even just bone imaging have not had a benefit. So we would consider then switching them to denosumab. Patients in renal failure, you know, again, while it's not approved, it certainly is another group of patients where we would consider using it.
And it's not as hard on the kidneys as the bisphosphonates are.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your answers.
Thank you, Jack. Cindy, are you on?
I am. Can you hear me?
All right. Good. Yes, oh. Certainly can. Your question, Cindy?
Hi. Sure. Thanks so much, Dr. Krishnan. I'm one of those patients who had extensive bone damage. I lost 3.5 inches in height, and my MRI read that there's too many lytic lesions to be counted. So my bones are like Swiss cheese. So this is a very interesting topic to me. And my first question is, I was reading about a test called the CTX serum test that can be used as an indicator of bone breakdown and reabsorption. For example, that if people whose bone breakdown is very high, the CTX levels will be high, and when the bone turnover is decreased by bisphosphonate, the CTX levels become lower. Would this test ever be able to be used to determine if a myeloma patient should extend their bisphosphonate use beyond the recommended 2 years?
You know, that's another really interesting and good question. So you're absolutely right. You know, our endocrinologists certainly do use these bone turnover markers. You know, there's some caveats with them. First of all, kind of our levels of what we call normal or elevated, there's a lot of variability between patients. So that's one challenge in terms of really what do you call as your cutoff. But I agree with kind of your statement that lower levels do indicate. So we would, our endocrinologists use them in, to guide to exactly that issue of saying, okay, the bisphosphonates are working, meaning if our bone resorptive markers are being suppressed. So now, on the other hand, we haven't reached the point or have any studies to suggest to us that they help guide us in terms of when to stop bisphosphonates, for example.
So should a myeloma patient consider consulting with an endocrinologist and have this test done just to have some baseline data on where their levels are so that they may be able to make a decision about whether or not to continue those that use beyond the 2 years?
So we certainly, work very closely with our endocrinologists. I mean, I think we've tended to do it for people, in sort of your situation, too, who have fairly advanced bony disease. And, clearly we want to do everything we can to help heal that and maximize it. So I think it's certainly reasonable to consider that. The other challenge is even among our own endocrinologists, and we're obviously a very specialized center, they have their own niches, so we're lucky we have one who clearly that's her sort of bailiwick is sort of bone turnover, osteoporosis. So it's easy for us to, sort of funnel patients specifically to her for these sort of, more complex questions. And it's a little bit harder in the community where, an endocrinologist isn't as familiar with sort of the nuances in regards to myeloma versus, diabetes or even just osteoporosis per se.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to find endocrinologists that talked about, this bone turnover. And I live in a metropolitan area, and it was very, very hard to find somebody that really specialized in this area. So it would be nice if there would be some kind of list somewhere of those specific types of endocrinologists. Well, that's just a side point. And another question I had is about these lytic-lit lesions that are throughout my body. I've heard two differing opinions on them. One opinion says that the bone lesions will disappear completely when treated, and the other tells me that once I have these bone lesions, they will always be there. They might not be active if I'm treated successfully, but they will always be there. And interesting what you just said, something about that the Velcade, there was a study saying the Velcade did bone remodeling. So should we extend our use of Velcade until our bones are completely rebuilt? So something like that.
Well, I guess I'd say certainly there's data just in general with myeloma therapy of sort of duration of therapy matters. Now, whether that's Velcade versus even the IMiD, certainly, you could sort of indirectly say have some benefit in terms of bone. I mean, because really it's sort of treat the myeloma successfully and you're going to help inhibit all the anti-bone effects of active myeloma. So, I wouldn't use just the bone reasons alone for, continued Velcade, but I'd as my sort of baseline. Now, the other question in regards to do bones ever become normal is obviously, as you said, you heard sort of both ends of the spectrum. I mean, I can only tell you my clinical practice. I have patients who've had myeloma over 10 years, for example, and if I do a PET scan on them, I will still see lytic lesions that don't light up. So, and these are people in remission or very close to it who really don't have active myeloma. Some of them have not been on treatment at all for years. So, I tend to fall more in the camp that the lesions are always going to be there, but they may not be active.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Pat Killingsworth, your question.
Hi, Gary. Hello, doctor.
Hi, Pat.
Often, and I guess I'm the patient that's had a lot of bone involvement that Gary described, but my first question has to do with vocabulary. These words seem to be used interchangeably a lot, lesion, tumor, plasmacytoma. So I guess my question is, for example, can a lesion be a plasmacytoma or a plasmacytoma be a lesion and vice versa? Could you clear that up a little bit?
So, you know, that's a great question, Pat. You're kind of holding your doctor to the fire then, because it really is sort of up to us to be a little bit more precise in our language, and we do tend to use them interchangeably, but they really don't necessarily mean the same thing. So, and to each individual physician, they probably also mean something different. You know, for example, for at least myself, and when I think of a plasmacytoma, I think of it as sort of a solid sort of tumor of a collection of plasma cells. If I think of bony lesions, I think of those more as holes in the bone. And so that's not necessarily that you can even find plasma cells when you biopsy those lesions, you know, but it may be from what we talked about, the signal sent to the bone to sort of chew away at the bone.
Sure. So a plasmacytoma is, in a sense, a form of tumor, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's helpful and good. I had another question for you too, and I understand you talked about that every patient, you know, it's just the way that their myeloma cells or plasma cells are interacting. I'm not quite sure I understand the whole communication back and forth thing, but for example, I develop lesions at such a low M spike, 0.5, 0.6, and I'm developing active lesions, where other people can have a 3.0. And can you shed some light on that, other than saying, well, everybody's different?
You know, I think it sort of describes the patient. For example, I have a patient whose M spike, yeah, is 0.1, but if you do a PET CT, he has disease everywhere. So it is really that issue of what are the signals and how is it acting? Is your myeloma basically a big secretor where it's basically more the protein that it's secreting, or is it more just the other signals that it's sending instead to your bones, for example? And it may not take a lot of plasma cells, but the ones you have are, you know, quite active in sort of sending those signals.
Interesting. So do you have any advice that makes it difficult to treat? For example, I've relapsed for the third time, and at some point, you know, it becomes more and more difficult to keep the M spike down. So I have images of myself sort of falling apart as my M spike starts to creep up, and there's not much we can do about it.
I think you've kind of sort of hit the nail on the head, though, when you say that, for example, for you who have a very low M spike, but you still have other signs of active myeloma, so in your case, it's really not the M spike that would drive the decision to treat, but it also makes it challenging, as you know, because many clinical trials, in fact, require a certain level of M spike, and you know, it sounds like from what you're describing in your case, you don't want to wait till you get to that level. You know, you may never get to that level because your myeloma may not act like that. I mean, as in the patient I've described, he has extremely active disease, but his M spike is incredibly low. You know, so, you know, I hate to keep going back to that point, but so I don't think I would use that to say that your disease is going to be any more resistant to therapy, but it just means that how you're followed would have to be somewhat different and not just to use the M spike as the only indication of your response to treatment.
Understood, and good point about the clinical trials, because that's exactly the challenge that I've faced. And for example, my light chain ratio is normal, you know, so I can't sneak in through the back door there, and you know, I don't meet that universal threshold of the 1.0. So yeah, we've been running into some problems trying to get me in clinical trials. Well, thank you, doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you, doctor.
Hey, you're welcome.
Yes, Priya, it's time for us to go to our callers. Could you bring the callers online?
Thank you, Gary. Listeners, if you have a question for our panel and you would like to ask it live on the show, please press 1 on your keypads and we can bring you on air to ask your question. Yes, we have a caller. The caller from 805-527-1702, please ask your question.
Yes. Hello?
Your question?
Yes.
Yes, you're on air. Please ask your question.
My question is, we went to a clinic, and my wife was prescribed Velcade in order to treat her myeloma.
Turn that down, will you?
And even though she received it subcutaneously, she got severe neuropathy, which has affected her stability and her ability to walk. She now is in remission, and the bone marrow is clear. But is there anything we can do or any drug we can take which would assist in her neuropathy being lessened so her stability would return? And is that an obvious side effect of Velcade treatment?
Well, you know, I should say, so some of the things that we're understanding with Velcade and neuropathy, you know, is we do think it's probably an off-target effect from the proteasome inhibition. So it's not necessarily a class effect of all proteasome inhibitors. Having said that, we also now recognizing we're doing a lot of things called pharmacogenomic studies, trying to understand why do some people, and I've seen patients who have had 1-2 doses of Velcade get incredible neuropathy, and other people who can be on it for a year, 2 years without problems. So pharmacogenomics is trying to understand this, and there are some data suggesting that there are certain profiles genetically of people more predisposed to it than others in terms of getting neuropathy. And you're right, it sounds like whoever treated you already tried sort of up front to minimize the risk by giving it subcutaneously, which clearly has been shown to have much less risk of neuropathy. You know, certain groups of patients, and I don't know if your wife falls into that category, at higher risk of getting neuropathy regardless, patients who are older, patients who have diabetes, not surprisingly, people who have pre-existing neuropathy. Now, the good news is, yes, the neuropathy with Velcade can get better. The not so good news is it can take a while. And so the treatments we have for it really are not treatments for the neuropathy. They're more treatments for the symptoms. So you know, I'm sure they've already been tried on her, you know, certain drugs to help neuropathic pain. You know, I tend to use a lot of the stuff, sort of more homeopathic stuff too, sort of, you know, alpha-lipoic acid. It's been shown in trials with diabetic neuropathy. There's some vitamin B6, certainly, because that's very important in terms of nerve function. And some people even find just topical stuff. For example, mentholated creams, there's been one study published on that, or cocoa butter is another thing that, you know, has been sometimes shown to just symptomatically give some relief. And I've anecdotally heard of some patients actually acupuncture, you know, but I haven't seen anything really published or formally studied in that regard.
Thank you, Doctor. We have another caller online. Person calling into 954-688-9090. Please ask your question.
Good evening, and thank you. My question is that, and perhaps it's been answered already, I'm not really sure, but I was diagnosed originally in March of 2012, and I had lytic lesions in my skull, in my pelvis, in my spine, and a plasmacytoma in my right clavicle that was the root cause of finding out that I had myeloma to begin with. And a PET CT scan showed all these different things. 6 months later, in October, my skeleton was clear. No plasmacytoma, no lytic lesions were found in a PET CT scan. I'm just wondering if you've ever heard of this before.
No, you're a rare bird. I have not seen that, especially that quickly. So, no.
No, well, thanks be to God. A lot of prayer.
Thank you. Dr. Krishnan, we've received quite a few questions. I think we can just go through them. The first one is from Fran, who asks, once damage occurs in the bones from myeloma, can these bones be re-strengthened with proper treatment, or is treatment just to keep additional damage from taking place?
You know, it's another good question. I would say, in fact, you can re-strengthen your bones, and that's part of, you know, what the bisphosphonates help do in terms of allowing the osteoblasts to work more. And then doing all the other things that we just do, even in people without myeloma bone disease, with patients with osteoporosis, for example. So our bone endocrinologists are very big on that. You know, what I had mentioned earlier, vitamin D, calcium, having people walk, they have them do sort of light exercises, all those kind of things, you know, help in terms of rebuilding and strengthening bones.
The next one is from Carl, who asks, how often do the skeletal holes that appear as part of the onset of myeloma heal and disappear from PET or CT scans? And he says this has happened to him.
So I'm not sure if that was Carl who was on the phone before. I mean, it's a rarity, I would say. And this is, you know, just based on my own anecdotal experience, I would say probably in less than 10% or less of patients that they quote-unquote disappear. It's common for them to become inactive on PET scan, but not to, you, if you do it, well, I call it PET CT. So I'm also, when he says disappear, I'm not sure if that means by CT if there's no lytic lesions. But, you know, by PET scan, it's very common that things when you treat the myeloma will not light up anywhere, but that if you look at the CT portion, you can still see lytic lesions.
Yeah. The next question, Dr. Krishnan, I think you have already answered, but I just maybe you could summarize it for the person who's sending the question specifically. He asked, in the absence of obvious bone disease, do you recommend bisphosphonate use for myeloma patients? If so, how do you determine dosage and when or if to discontinue bisphosphonate use? He also asked, do you recommend that myeloma patients see an endocrinologist or other specialist who might be able to help determine the appropriate amount of bisphosphonate for the particular patient?
So you're right. So I, you know, we have sort of our own guidelines that are sort of an amalgamation of the Mayo Clinic guidelines and the ASCO guidelines. I've generally used 2 years of bisphosphonates and then stopped if patients don't have active myeloma. If they do have active myeloma, I've continued on every 3-month basis. And yeah, those are the kind of patients where I do send them to our endocrinologists who help in terms of doing these bone biomarkers to really see, you know, how effective in terms of are we in terms of bone turnover. And, you know, obviously there's this question, too, in terms of the bone remodeling, that with long-term bisphosphonate use has also been a concern that you're developing more brittle bones. So, you know, it's balancing, again, the risk versus benefits of long-term bisphosphonate use.
Okay, the next one is from Lizzie Smith, and she writes in saying that I have had some pain since diagnosis. After tandem transplants in 2012, I am in remission. Still, from time to time, I have bone pain flare-ups. Why is that, and what can be done? And she also asks, will it ever go away forever?
Well, I think probably some of the callers on you know, can answer this even better than I can. But, you know, certainly people who have, and she doesn't mention where her bone pain is, but for example, if you have compression fractures, you know, that unfortunately just gravity working against you too. So, and your spine alignment, you know, completely changes. So it's very common for people in that situation to have long-term pain, even with their myelomas in remission. And I, you know, I certainly, even though, you know, I'm an advocate for example, of transplant, as I'm very clear with patients up front that, you know, we can get your myeloma remission with this approach, but it doesn't necessarily mean that your bone pain is going to go away, you know. And so it is definitely, you know, it comes back to that question, do your bones ever go back to normal or not?
We have Ed here who's sending his skeletal report, without a question, so maybe he just wants an opinion on what the report states. It says a 2.8 centimeter lucent lesion high parietal calvarium with overlying soft tissue thickening, suspicious of developing plasmacytoma. I am starting Vimetra and Doxil for treatment of this issue and to lower my protein and IgA. Maybe you could give him your opinion.
Yeah, that's a hard one without a little bit more, you know, information in regards to what his bone marrow biopsy looks like, his IgA levels, you know, does he have just a solitary plasmacytoma or does he have sort of active systemic myeloma? I guess I could just say the generalization, if he has sort of active myeloma, I generally have not used just Doxil alone as treatment for it. And sort of leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah. The next question asks, what is your opinion of high dose of Velcade being responsible for peripheral neuropathy? And he asks, why does City of Hope give the maximum dosages that is suggested by manufacturer, even though severe neuropathy is a very likely side effect?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I think, again, we have to balance. I wouldn't think of it as maximum doses. I would think of it more as the recommended doses that have been shown to be effective. And so, you know, we want to balance getting a maximum response because there's certainly a lot of data in myeloma saying that your depth of response, you know, can correlate with survival. So clearly, you know, if we're going to treat someone, we want to try to treat them with the intent of getting the best response. Now, having said that, we also recognize clearly the risk of neuropathy, and we're very quick to sort of adjust our doses if we need to. And in fact, my experience has been the opposite, where I've had patients where I say, you know, I want to cut back your Velcade, and they are the ones who pushed back to me and said, no, it's working. I don't want to reduce the dose. So I think it's really balancing both together.
We have received quite a few questions on Vimetra. I'll just quickly go through them. One person, Joan, asks, if you don't tolerate Vimetra very well and don't want radiation, do you have suggestions for the mitigation of bone pain while strengthening the bones? She says she had kyphoplasty in January and is still wearing a fentanyl patch for pain.
So I think it's important to sort out what the bone strengthening agents do. So they help in terms of, you know, of increasing sort of bone, I guess, preventing new events and potentially in terms of increasing bone remodeling and bone growth, but they don't have any effects in regards to pain per se. So, you know, in terms of mitigation of bone pain, really bisphosphonates would not be helping her anyway, and there's certainly even less data in terms of denosumab. So, you know, those unfortunately really are just, again, typical symptomatic therapy of treating pain depending on where it is, radiation, pain medicine, as she's mentioned that she's on a fentanyl patch, nerve block if it's, you know, in an area that's amenable to that is another option, and she's already had kyphoplasty, you know, and so, you know, it sounds like they are really going through the algorithms of things that we do for that pain. You know, I don't love radiation just because I'm also a bone marrow transplant, and certainly if you radiate, especially vertebrae, you're radiating a lot of where your bone marrow is and just making it harder to collect stem cells down the road. But clearly, you know, radiation is actually quite effective at helping with pain.
Yeah, the next one on Vimetra is Sherry wants to know how safe is Vimetra, and Sherry here wants to know how long should one take Vimetra for bone strengthening.
So those are two great, you know, and very difficult questions, really. So I guess safety, if you mean in terms of risks of mortality, it's very safe. But if you mean in terms of other potential side effects, you know, the one obviously that we worry about the most is this issue of osteonecrosis of the jaw. And, you know, the data has kind of been a little bit all over the place. But, for example, in the Myeloma 9 trial, it was about 3.5% ONJ incidence. Some other studies have suggested up as high as 6%. There have been a lot of sort of what we call retrospective studies looking back, you know, at patients treated with Zometa for years and trying to figure out what are the risks for getting, for example, osteonecrosis of the jaw. And we do see that length of infusion, and some of the trials suggested patients getting over 3 years had a higher risk. And so that sort of why some of these guidelines also came about in terms of including our own of, you know, monthly for 2 years and then going to every 3 months to try and minimize that risk.
Thank you, doctor. And there's another question from Bob, who says, I'm 80 years old, and does that rule out a stem cell transplant? I will have my first diagnosis after blood test, skeletal survey, and 24-hour urine test. Are these enough to know where I am in stage, or which stage I am in?
I'm sorry, so he said he had a bone marrow biopsy, skeletal survey, and blood test. So yeah, the staging for myeloma, actually, I mean, so we use the international staging system now, which is, well, he needs all those tests in terms of helping make his initial diagnosis, especially the bone marrow biopsy and blood tests. The staging system is really based on blood tests, so his albumin and his beta-2 microglobulin. So I'm assuming that they've done that as part of the blood work that he mentions.
Okay, we have quite an interesting question here. Shelley writes in asking if she can still ride horses after her diagnosis with myeloma.
I guess it depends on two things. One, how good a rider she is, and you know, where her bony disease is, really.
Okay, hi, Dr. Krishna. I think that's the end of the questions that I've received, people have sent in. It would be very good if you could talk a little bit about the research that is being done currently on myeloma and bone health.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Priya.
Yes, it would be great if you could just talk a little bit on research that is being done on myeloma and bone health.
So I think a lot of the research has really been in terms of these bone markers and certainly RANK ligand, and then actually looking at also some of these other newer agents. For example, you may have heard about a drug called ibrutinib. It's a Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It was approved earlier in the year for lymphoma, but it's very interesting that this class of drugs has effects in certain of these cell pathways or the NF-kappa-B pathway really being the one that we see activity, and that may, in fact, also lead to inhibition of osteoclasts, so the cells that chew up bone. So that's a definite some of the data is looking at these other agents already approved for other diseases, but looking at the indirect effects they have maybe on bony disease and myeloma. So that's been very intriguing. People have looked at all these radiopharmaceuticals, and many of them have come and gone. For example, strontium was around for a while, and that's sort of come and gone. I talked a little bit already about bortezomib, and you know, clearly that's been already shown to be and help in terms of helping osteoblasts, so growing bone, and it's already obviously most people it's a mainstay of therapy anyway. There's some other kind of other drugs out there as well that are in the future as well. You know, this concept of certainly the immunomodulatory agents are still also effective. So lenalidomide, for example, also reduces osteoclast effects, and there are a couple other agents out there too that were going to look at, so down the stream, looking at other sort of pathways, you know, sclerostin, activin, all those agents, so inhibitors of all of those are, you know, I think down the road certainly going to be studied.
I have another question, and maybe...
Yes, this Gary, I have a question from Lee, who just mailed it to me, Dr. Krishna.
Okay.
What is the significance of having sclerotic in addition to lytic lesions?
There's no clear known significance in terms of prognosis. It's fairly rare. I mean, certainly what I've seen is people either have sclerotic bones or they have lytic disease. So, I mean, I guess you could surmise that it may be just different stages of their bony disease that you're catching.
Okay. I'll just go over the panels again if they won't have. I've asked you now the question, Gary.
Yes, I have another question. Doctor,
yeah.
One of the things about Zometa is that they say don't get, you know, invasive dental work, and that can exacerbate, I guess. Is that you know, is that the, you know, in this 6% or 3% or whatever it is it tied to people getting dental work and that causing the problem?
In conjunction
with Zometa, or is it irrespective of if you have dental work or not?
It's in part irrespective. So we do something called multivariate analysis, which is basically looking at risk factors individually. Some of it is very hard because these studies are sort of going back in time and trying to tie it together. So that also makes it difficult to really narrow it down. But, there are people, so it's just additive risk. So longer time you use bisphosphonates, you're going to be at higher risk. We feel that if you have invasive dental work, it's just going to increase your risk on top of that, or as an individual risk factor, for example. So I would say probably all of those are separate risk factors.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Can I ask a question?
Pat? Okay, Jack, you got a question?
Yeah, it basically has to do with the question of why do you prescribe Zometa versus Auridia? Other than the shorter infusion time, is there a reason to prescribe one over the other? Or prescribe Auridia over Zometa? For example, is one harder or easier on kidneys? Is one less likely to cause O&J than the other? Is one more effective than the other? Could you kind of summarize that?
So we certainly still use both. So you're right, as azelaic acid, you give it a 15 minutes versus, you know, pimidronate or Auridia is over an hour. Pimidronate has much less kidney toxicity. So if patients who are renally impaired or have kidney damage, we will use pimidronate. I think that data has kind of fallen off, that maybe there was less O&J, osteonecrosis of the jaw, with pimidronate. But, you know, I think that's not been clearly proven. The other reason I would say we use a lot of zoledric acid is, yes, absolutely, 15 minutes is much more patient-friendly. And also, a lot of the trials in terms of showing potential benefit, for example, the MRC not trial that we talk about a lot, the arm was zoledric acid versus clodronate or an oral bisphosphonate. So we have a little bit more robust data suggesting, for example, survival benefits with zoledric acid, which we don't have with pimidronate.
Although I remember when pimidronate first came out and they talked that it might have a myeloma benefit as well. I think it's just that tests really haven't, as you mentioned, we don't have as much robust data for that.
I think that's reasonable, yes. And I don't think it's wrong to use pimidronate at all. I think it's certainly, and for a variety of reasons, certainly we do have people on it.
Thank you.
Cindy, Pat?
I've got a couple questions, Gary.
Okay, Pat?
Doctor, two things that you mentioned prompted my question. The first was about radiation. I've had several patients from UAMS, they're in Arkansas, tell me that they discourage using radiation in myeloma patients and seem to think that it has a negative effect, even though, of course, it can help with pain and to shrink specific lesions. Are you familiar with that?
What I'd mentioned earlier, so, you know, you radiate, and certainly most of the time certain areas I don't mind radiating, you know, if it's in the leg, if it's in the arm, but if you're radiating somewhere, example, in the vertebrae, so you're basically your vertebrae and your pelvis contain most of your bone marrow. So if you're going to radiate those areas, you're going to then have higher chance that people's blood counts are going to remain low, which then makes it challenging to give other treatments, for example, chemotherapy. So that's really why. You know, I think radiation is sort of spot welding. Sure, I use it in terms of if someone's having pain that I can't control any other way, but it's not really going to have an overall impact in terms of treating the myeloma.
Okay, sure. So I probably shouldn't tell you that I just had both iliums radiated last month. Sure,
well,
helps with the pain, though.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's sort of everything in context, right, in terms of what other options there are, right? So sometimes that's the best option.
Sure, appreciate it. And Doxil, now I know it seemed like Doxil was being used a lot more until these shortages popped up. Can you give us a status update? Do you still prescribe it? It seems to have sort of gone away.
Yeah, I rarely use Doxil, even after the shortages. I just think that there's a lot of other good drugs that are much more effective. I can't even think, to be honest, of the last time I've prescribed it. It certainly wasn't this year. And it's really just because it's been supplanted by other options. So, you know, for example, we use a lot more bendamustine for patients with relapse disease. Other combinations of sort of already approved drugs we use, and obviously clinical trials.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, you wouldn't use it by itself, but as a combination. But you didn't even find it that effective as a part of a combination therapy.
Not really, and I guess that sort of tells you just the nuances of myeloma, right? It's every physician somewhat different. Every center is different too, in terms of some centers, I'm sure, use it a lot more than others.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Doctor, I have one other question.
Has...
Oh, you got a question?
Gary, after you ask your question, I think Cindy do have a small quick question for Dr. Akushan.
Okay. Yes, Doctor, I was wondering, you know, there's a kind of a continuum of treatment. It goes from, like, less is best, which is Dr. Berenson, to more is cure, which is, you know, Dr. Barlogi. And then everybody kind of falls, you know, and then people fall in the middle, and probably someplace in the middle is Dana-Farber and Mayo. Where, you know, if you had to describe your program, where is it, you know, where does it fall on that continuum? And for the people, like the 85% of low-risk people, you know, what would be your suggested, therapy?
I think, and I'm not even saying it because I trained there, but we tend to certainly fall kind of in that middle spectrum. I mean, I firmly believe sort of in an individualized approach to myeloma, and, you know, certainly we're, you know, one of the biggest transplant centers in the country. But having said that, I don't believe that transplant is a necessity for every patient, and I don't believe that it's the only route in terms of optimizing your treatment of myeloma. I believe it's one of the choices, and we make that sort of with each individual patient. You know, and I guess I have to say, obviously, I'm sure Dr. Barlogi would say it, Dr. Behrens would say it. I've been at their talks, you know, of terms of showing survival curves and saying, I have someone living, you know, 15 years, 20 years with myeloma. And Dr. Barlogi would show it, someone living 20 years with myeloma after two transplants and 2 years of intensive therapy. Dr. Berenson would show it when someone's staying on low doses of therapy. And I think, to be honest, that's really more the biology of that patient's myeloma. And I'm on a lot of sort of national committees in terms of sort of figuring out what are the next trials we should do for myeloma, one of them being the State of the Science Committee for Myeloma. And that's the key question also for us, is sort of recognizing when do you need to be very aggressive and when are there patients where, in fact, you can back down. Patients have good disease where you really don't need to do as much, and those people are going to do well. And so that's, I think, the challenge for us to sort out in a more sort of rigorous fashion.
Do you have one of those curves that shows what your 5-year survival is and for your low-risk patient newly diagnosed?
So that curve, I would just say, is a shifting curve because, you know, even the last 5 years, the treatment has changed completely. So if you look at Mayo Clinic's data, in fact, from 2005 onward, the survival's already completely improved as well. So, you know, we are in the process of sort of compiling all of that data. We've looked at just our transplant data over the last 10 years. We did 900 transplants. But the problem is how we treated myeloma 10 years ago is totally different than what we do now.
Well,
so
when you do come up with that, I'd love to be able to share that with the people that read my blog.
Absolutely.
So I look forward to seeing that information. Priya?
Yes. Cindy, you're on air. Please ask your question.
Okay. Hi, Doctor. There was something that you said that prompted a question in my mind. I guess it's a vocabulary question once again. You were saying that maybe after 2 years, if you still had active disease, that you would consider continuing treatment with Zometa. Now, what exactly is active disease? If you're in a very good partial remission and your disease is stable, is that considered active? Or is active disease if your numbers are continuing to increase? Or is non-active disease a stringent complete remission? So
that's a good question. I think it's a somewhat of a gray zone, but I always consider sort of stable, very good partial remission. So if you've been in a very good partial remission for a year, for example, I would consider that not active disease. And, you know, definitely anyone who's a complete remission, stringent complete remission, also not active disease.
Thank you, Doctor. I think we're almost come to the end of the 60 minutes. Another question, I think it has been great listening to you. We had a lot of people who have logged in to hear your discussion with the panel today. And I thank the panel, Gary, Jack, Cindy, and Pat and Cindy. Thank you so very much for being here. The link for today's broadcast I will be shared with all our participants as well as all our listeners. Please visit curepanel.carefeet.net to register for our shows. Until then, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Krishnan.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Excellent questions, too. Enjoy talking to everyone. Bye-bye.
You did excellent. Appreciate it.